Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, and welcome to Indie Streak. My name is Rachel Galvin, and as you know, I interview film industry professionals on this show. If you've missed any of the shows, you can go back and listen to the archives. Well, today I'm interviewing Nikki Brainlin, director of As High as the Sky, which was just shown at the Palm Beach International Film Festival. And I believe I have Nikki on the line. Let me check here. Nikki, are you there?
Hey, Rachel.
Hey.
I am here. With a
great.
Bit of a cold, I have to apologize.
No problem. Okay. Well, for those who haven't seen the movie, tell us a little bit about the plot.
As High as the Sky, yeah, it centers around Margaret, a woman with OCD who's forced to confront the root of it when her estranged sister and niece show up on her doorstep. So there's only three main characters. We have the two aunts' voices off camera on the phone throughout, but otherwise it's just about three women dealing with some tragedies in their past and the grief that has accompanied it.
How did you come up with this idea?
Well, it was a different writing process for me because I had the location and the actresses and then needed to create a story around that. And I had always, I do struggle with OCD. I always say, like, not of the cleaning variety that, like, Margaret has, unfortunately. I definitely wanted to explore the causes of OCD and potential ways to heal. And it's sort of an amalgam of different things. I do have an older sister who's 8.5 years older than I am, and we didn't grow up together. And she spent some time on communes like Josephine did. And so I just kind of pulled together different elements of, you know, from my life and tried to create a central theme around those. Yeah.
Did you learn something about your own OCD by doing this?
Well, yeah, it was, my OCD was, I knew that it always was exacerbated under stress, and it, and, you know, being the director for my first project as a feature film, it definitely didn't help that. So it was interesting because I was kind of, you know, exploring OCD while I was experiencing these, you know, exacerbated symptoms. But I think it definitely helped, you know, talk with Caroline about it, Caroline Fogarty that plays Margaret, and learning that I need to, you know, kind of explore the roots of my own OCD. So in a sense it did, yes.
Did you always have OCD or did it develop later on?
You know, it was something that I didn't really put a label on until I was about 30. And at that point I could kind of look back and realize, you know, where the symptoms had manifested themselves, because I would kind of be like, oh, I'm quirky Nikki. You know, my friends would be like, oh, you're so silly. You have to go and tap everything, you know, because I was always kind of, you know, like silly and doing weird creative stuff and kind of, you know, to my own, dancing my own beat. And so I didn't realize until in my 20s it really became debilitating in different aspects. And so it wasn't until, like I said, in my 30s that I really kind of realized what it was and then was able to kind of deal with it at that point.
Okay. And you've done a lot of things in the creative industry. You've been an actor, you're a screenwriter. What made you decide to finally direct?
Well, I had directed some small theater. I'd studied at Stella Adler Academy of Acting out here in Los Angeles, and one of the great things there is we direct, the students direct their other students at the end of every semester in these sort of small one-act plays, and so I started directing through there, and then when I started writing, it just sort of was the natural progression because I wanted to direct the things that I write, you know? And so I was definitely comfortable working with the actors. It was just sort of the technical aspects of filmmaking I had to kind of take a crash course on before we went into production, just so I could talk somewhat intelligently with the other crew members, specifically our director of photography, you know, that I would just have the technical terms down. So yeah, it was kind of, I knew when I began writing the screenplays that I wanted to direct them. I didn't really want to hand them over to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, my background with the acting and theater definitely helped in that regard.
What's your writing process like? Do you have to kind of mull over for a long time, or do you do an outline, or how do you work when you write?
You know, I've tried to outline and beat sheet. It doesn't really work for me because I didn't study it formally. I don't have a process that's been kind of ingrained in me.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to live in that world for months.
Mm-hmm.
I have a notebook that I carry around. I'm constantly ruminating on the characters and the storyline. And I start writing kind of whatever I'm feeling that day. If I'm not really feeling the characters and the dialogue, I'll just start writing it out in prose as to what I think will happen. And if I'm feeling, you know, particularly spunky, then I'll start writing some dialogue. And I've really found that when I start writing the scenes, it starts to dictate the rest of the screenplay to me.
Mm-hmm.
I do like to, when I go in, at least know what the ending is going to be. Because I think otherwise I'm
yeah.
just off in any sort of direction, and it's not really helpful. So I would say I have a vague outline. You know, I have kind of the midpoint, and I know how it's going to end. Because otherwise, it would just be a meandering journey. But I don't knock it out. Like, I have friends, screenwriters, who do an entire beat sheet. They have everything written down before they even start writing the dialogue. But I just have found that the characters, when I start writing it, they sort of dictate to me how it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the ants. I know you're telling a funny story at the film festival about how you got some of the dialogue for the ants and how you determined there were two. Tell us about that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely, the ants are definitely an amalgam of different sources. And I was saying there's only one line in the film that I stole. The rest came from me. Mm-hmm. And I was sitting at a film festival waiting for a film to start, and a couple was sitting next to me, and he said, oh, you know, it's so awful. You know, so-and-so down the street was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And I, in my own head, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, it's a terrible disease. And the woman goes, oh. And then she said, well, how is she going to drink her coffee? Her husband kind of paused, and I was like, oh, da 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 do do, like, don't mind me as I bend down to pick up my notebook, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the line went immediately into my notebook, and then 6 months later it went into the ants. And then the ants are also particularly conscientious of Margaret doing her Kegel exercises, and that was sort of an homage to my sweet mom, who's listening right now.
Hi, Mom.
Hi, Mom. At every stoplight growing up, my mom would say, are you doing your Kegels? I was like, Mother. She goes, you know, you should do them at every single stoplight. I'm doing mine right now. I was like, I don't need that visual. Thank you. But I tell you what, ever since it went into the screenplay, she has not asked me. She got the hint. So, yeah, I kind of pulled from them. And the idea of the ants was really that, you know, they love Margaret very much, and they raised her the way that they thought, you know, was helpful, and that was shielding her. And so, you know, it's not giving away anything to say that Margaret and Josephine, the two sisters, were orphaned when they were young. I think that's already in the trailer. And so Margaret was four when her parents died. And, you know, the aunts never spoke of it. And that was another thing, too. I had dated a guy whose previous girlfriend had been orphaned when she was five. And in this horrible plane crash that had happened. And I never met her, but it just really stayed with me because I'm very close with my parents. And I just was wanting to explore sort of that situation. So, you know, I chose to write that into the script, and I felt like someone, Margaret at 4 years old, who was never allowed to even identify or feel an emotion or understand what it is, and the ants were doing it seemingly for her benefit, but obviously, it kind of backfired and made it much more difficult for Margaret to grasp anything in her life, really. So,
how long did it take you to write the screenplay?
This was actually fast for me, which was about 6 months. Wow. Normally, and it could be some of my OCD, it takes a lot longer just to really perfect it, you know, to where I'm happy with the script. But this one kind of came about really quickly for me, and part of it was I would do a draft, and then I'd get together with Caroline and Bonnie and read through it and talk about it, and then I'd go back and kind of adjust it and just try to hone in on really the main themes and kind of, you know, disregard anything that started to seem sort of extemporaneous or, you know, in excess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You talked about the location earlier, which is it's an amazing house, and I know it's Carolyn's house. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, I was living in the house. I had moved back to Los Angeles, and Caroline said, well, why don't you just come stay with Andrew and I, her husband, until you find a place? And so I stayed for 2 years, just because when you get there, you don't really want to leave, you know?
Right.
It's just such a beautiful, spacious house, and there's so much sunlight, and it's wonderful. But it was when I was living there, and I, you know, was writing, I have like three other, you know, finished screenplays, and I said, you know, I need to practice directing, and Caroline does a lot of commercials, and most people will recognize her from that. She has her own YouTube page and everything, but she always plays these really, like, wacky, offbeat characters, and I said,
quirky.
Why don't... Yeah, very, very quirky. I'm like, why don't I write something for you that you don't normally get to audition for, and then I'll direct it, and we can shoot it in your house, and it'll be kind of a quid pro quo thing, and so I wrote it in having the location in mind. I set aside a room for the production office and everything. So it was very helpful to already know the location inside and out and be able to make sure that the film wouldn't get stagnant by being in one house. They have a lot of, you know, they have a big yard and a pool and everything. So I just tried to make sure that we're always moving within the space.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is a very, so it's an Eichler house, and it's mid-century modern, and they keep it decorated as such. And then, so it's a very minimalist decor, which also lends itself to somebody who might have OCD and not want anything around that she has to, like, adjust or dust or anything like that. But and that kind of came into play, my OCD, I was saying, and I didn't mean it, you know, badly to say, unfortunately, it's not cleaning because that is painful, but I'm the messiest person you'll ever meet. And so to be living in that house was difficult because every room was completely neat, and then you'd walk into mine and it looked like, you know, a tornado had gone through.
Yeah.
And Caroline was always like, can you just keep your door shut? So yeah, it was kind of an interesting process. And Elsa, the dog, you know, lives there too.
Yes, the dog came with part of the package.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us about how you got your actors. I guess you'd known Carolyn for a while, and then tell us about Bonnie McNeil and everybody.
Yeah, Carolyn and I were friends from the late 90s. We did a student film together when we were both actors, and the whole group of us, the writer, director that was involved, and everybody has remained friends. And so I've known her for a long time. And then Bonnie McNeil, I actually was studying at Stella Adler, and she studied under Stella, you know, years ago. And her husband, Tim McNeil, who's a playwright and a teacher and an actor, became one of my best friends. He was one of my teachers. He was like my first scene study teacher. And I did my first scene for him, and he looked at me kind of funny, and he said, God, you remind me so much of my wife. And then I met Bonnie, and I was like, oh, yeah, we are a lot alike. And so we just became friends. And Bonnie does a lot of theater in Los Angeles. In 2011, she was nominated for an LADCC award for lead actress. But she also doesn't have a lot of opportunity to even audition for TV and film. It's just, you know, it's a difficult business. And I just think she's such a beautiful actress, and I really wanted her in the film. And so I wrote that part for her. So the only part that we cast for was Hannah, the little girl.
Mm-hmm. And then this is Laurel's first part in a film
anything.
Role,
yeah.
Right? Hannah.
Yeah, she had done a couple commercials that were basically, I think even non-speaking, just a couple small things. And it was just really serendipitous that we found her. I had called her agent for another actor because Laurel at the time wasn't on IMDb, and I was kind of surfing that website.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her agent for another girl, and she said, well, we don't represent her, but could I send you a list of other actresses? And Laurel was on that list. And, you know, I told the story. When we were auditioning, I had gone to the restroom, and I walked out, and this little girl passed me, and she had these, like, haphazard pigtails and little beads of sweat on her nose and these running socks pulled up to her knees, and I just had a reaction to her, and I just thought, oh, my God, I hope this little girl can act. And obviously, you know, it's what you see in the film. She came in and did that.
Yeah, she did great.
Did those performances. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the great thing about Laurel is that she's still – well, she's 13 now. When we were shooting, she was 11. And, you know, I told my producer, Lena Bubenichuk, when we'd started, I said, I really just wanted a natural kid. I just want a kid. I don't even care if they have acting, you know, an acting background. But she was like, well, let's just see, you know, let's try to get an actor first. And Laurel still had the playfulness of a kid, but also the seriousness and maturity where she can handle the depth of the character. So it was sort of, it was just exactly what I had envisioned and written, so it was a perfect match.
Was it difficult for her to do some of the crying scenes?
No, I mean, the day we actually shot one of the crying scenes early in the process, so she came in and she's like, I need to go get sad now. And I said, okay. And so she went back, and she's so cute because she was lying on the bed in the master bedroom, and Caroline came in, and she told her, she's like, I have a towel down so I don't get teardrops on your pillows. She's just so, you know, she's so sweet, and she already kind of knew the drill in the house. So, no, she uses stuff from her past, and I felt really badly that day because we did that scene several times. I mean, because it was one shot, you know, I didn't cut away a lot. I wanted it in a two shot, the scene when she's with Josephine. And so we did it probably 10 times, if not more. And she was a trooper. She said, you know, I mean, that was the acting that she had wanted to do. So, no, she was really able to focus. I mean, the great thing about Laurel is that I can tell her to go, you know, kind of get into character, and she'll be doing cartwheels in the backyard. But then uh-huh. Because she's a kid, you know, so that's what Hannah would be doing. And then she can just turn around and really sort of hone in and focus on what. We used to joke around that she was the most mature person on set.
Yeah.
But I think she just had a blast with it. I mean, she really loved, you know, learning all the different aspects of filmmaking, too, because the independent film is so, it's so intimate. You know, we're all, like, right there, and there's not a lot of crew. So she was able to really see all the different sides of it. So it was great.
Did you have casting at all? You only cast for her? That's the only
Yeah, no, we didn't have a casting director. We were trying to basically just save money. You know, that's mm-hmm. what it kind of had come down to. And I said, well, let's just see who we can get as a child actor first. Or like I said, I wanted to go to schools and audition people. And Lena's like, let's just see who we, you know, let's just see what we pull in. And I put down a breakdown, not to casting people, but on, I think it was on the Actors Access. And it's basically for uh-huh. any actor. Because when I was an actor, I didn't have representation for a long time. And it was very frustrating.
Right.
And I wanted to give
uh-huh.
people who didn't have an agent a chance to come in. So I saw about 50 or 60 different girls. And then for the aunts, we sort of circumvented the agent manager route and went straight to the actresses because, you know, it's kind of a tough sell to be like, hey, your actress is not going to be on camera at all and there's no money involved. And what do you think? You know, agents, they're not really going to be up for that. But both Dee Wallace and Jenny O'Hara just really responded to the film. We had already shot the entire film and edited it.
Okay.
And we had done kind of a rough edit of the scenes that they were in. So they were able to see the finished product and know, you know, kind of the level of professionalism that we're working on. And so they just both really responded to the story, and they came in for a couple hours and were wonderful, and we just had a great time. They were really fantastic.
How did you get the Roma Mafia?
We have a mutual friend. So
okay.
I had met her several times in different you know, social situation. So I just called her up and I said, would you mind, you know, it's basically, at the time I had just envisioned it where we don't even hear her talking. It's just because there is a music montage happening. There's a music over the montage. So I didn't even think we would see her, but it just worked out that she was, you know, hysterical and just, she's only on screen for what, like 5 or 10 seconds. But she just she just nailed it. She was just so perfect. So we kept on. So she teases me that the next script, the next film better have a bigger part for her.
Yeah.
But she's really fun. She's very laid back and just very, you know, generous and creative, and so it was great.
How long did it take you to shoot?
We shot it in 17 days.
Wow.
And it's interesting because even though it was in one location, you know, we didn't use natural light. We did use natural light, but we had, you know, full lighting and everything. So it was a different setup every single time. So even though we weren't actually packing up into a truck and moving, you know, there was some time that we'd do it. So basically I had to, Taryn Anderson, the DP, and I had sort of our dream list at the beginning, our dream shot list, you know, of all the coverage we'd want to have. And then from there, we pared it down to sort of a realistic list. And then when we got on set every day, we had to pare it down even more. And really, instead of doing different setups, I basically would do like 10 or 12 takes of just one, just to make sure I had it. And we didn't move on until I had the performance, you know, that I was thrilled with. So, you know, I definitely, it enabled me to take my time with it and to not just be constantly changing, you know, so. And I tend if you watch it, I do like to hold on two shots for a long time. I don't necessarily like to bounce.
That's what I was
going to
ask you.
Yeah, I like to just let the scene unfold, and especially, you know, when there's two of them or even three of them, I mean, I love the interplay when they work together and just playing off each other and seeing like the natural reaction, because otherwise you're kind of editing whatever reaction you want, and often it's from, you know, something that happened 10 minutes earlier in the scene, and so for a lot of this film, I'm just staying on just the two characters that are talking, so.
And that makes it more like theater.
Yeah. Also. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I'm sure they were more comfortable with also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the actors seem to feel, you know, when you say 17 days for a feature film, it kind of gets like, whoa. But I think all the actresses felt that they had, you know, given their top performances by the end of the day, that they weren't sort of cheated out of extra takes, you know? And oftentimes at the end, I would let them just kind of, gave them a couple takes to do whatever they wanted to. I was trying to kind of hone in on my vision of it and then let them play with it as well. And sometimes I did use those takes at the end.
You talked about the music earlier. Tell me, you know, who put together the music and how that came about, how that process worked.
Yeah, that was another harmonious thing. By the time we brought in Kristen, by the time we started meeting with composers, you know, we were in the editing process, and I was like, I just don't want to take like 10 different meetings, you know. And so Lena sent me several links to different composers, and I just was really drawn to Kristen Baum's music, and I said, let's meet with her. And we just, we had this meeting for brunch and it just really clicked, and she really got the story. And I had told her, you know, I said the music was kind of my biggest fear for me, just because I'm not a musically inclined person at all. I joke that I don't hear a rhythm. I don't feel a beat. I don't get it. I can't tell you the words to my favorite songs. Like, it's just not my realm of comfortability at all. And so she was really great because she said, well, don't try to talk to me in musical terms. Just talk to me like you would the actors. Talk to me in emotion and intention. Because I was trying to, I was like, oh, I kind of want it quirky, or I'd say I'd want it kind of plinky. And she's like, I don't know what plinky. I don't know what plinky means, Nikki. But, you know, there was a fine line in this where the music could really change, obviously, the tone of the film to make it more maudlin, you know, and I really didn't want to go in that direction. I wanted to keep it light. And so we did mix the music sort of low so that it's in there and you feel it, but it's not overpowering the scenes and the dialogue and what's happening with the characters, because I don't like, I told her, the one thing I know I don't like is when I watch movies and the music dictates to you what you're supposed to be feeling, you know? It's like, dun, 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 you know? And then they kind of zero in on the knife or something, and I'm like, okay, I get it. And so Kristen created different themes for each of the characters, using different instruments, and then also different themes between, like, the sisters, and then the mother-daughter have their own themes as well. So she wrote a lot of music for this piece. We did use all of it, I believe, but, yeah, she was great. She was fantastic. A guy had maybe a mild heart attack or something during our meeting. It was crazy, Rachel. Like, we were talking, and all of a sudden this guy, like, collapsed outside, and I was like, oh, my God. Like, what does this mean, you know? But
luckily,
so I'm going, I know CPR, I can do it. And Lena's like, I don't think you should do it unless you've done it before. I'm like, no, I know it. And Kristen's like, I don't know, what should we do? And it was just this very kind of, like, intense situation to start our whole, you know, work journey.
Wow.
The guy's okay. Yeah, he's fine. But, yeah, it kind of – and so I think that sort of – you know how you go through, like, difficult situations together? It kind of bonds you. And that was like, we were sort of instant friends after that, because we felt that we had kind of pushed through a very, you know, odd sort of traumatic event together. So, anyway.
You were also very involved editing.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to do the editing process?
So overall, it was several months, but what we would do is I worked with Laura Fisk, and I told her at the beginning, I said, I want to edit every scene very indulgently. So keep every moment, you know, do it as if it's its own movie. And then we'd go back and pare it down. So the first cut was even like an hour and 45 minutes. Just because I wanted, every beat and everything. So I think we worked for like 6 weeks on it and then got it down to like an hour and 35 minutes, and then we took some time. So we would take several weeks off and just kind of go and, you know, because you kind of have to be, you stop seeing the forest through the trees kind of thing, you know. So we had to kind of take a break and then come back and revisit it and tweak it and whatnot. So I would say it was about 6 months, but again, that wasn't the entire time in the editing room. But what I really found was, because the film is so about the pacing too, that we would tweak kind of one scene and it would have a ripple effect to the other scenes, to where it would make them appear a lot slower or, you know, quicker or whatever, and then we'd have to go in and fix those. But that's definitely my OCD kicked in. I mean, I was really down to, like, frame by frame at that point, because it is such an intimate piece, and the timing of it to me was so important, both the comedic and the drama, and I wanted to hold on a lot of the actresses' faces for a long time. I just think all of them have so much going on just in one close-up, that when you do that, though, I had to make sure that the other scenes and takes weren't doing the same thing, you know, because again, we're going to be there for 2 hours. So, you know, it took a while just to find the right tone throughout the whole film.
And the film won an audience award at the Palm Beach International Film Festival. Were you surprised?
Yeah. Well, we were thrilled. I mean, it was really exciting. The audience just responded so wonderfully to it. And our Q&A had to be cut off because we kept going with the questions on it. And it seems that when people are taken with this movie, they're really taken with it and very affected by it, which has been nice, and have talked about sort of the healing aspect of the film. And so, which is great. I mean, you know, it's kind of, our next film festival is the inaugural Shining Light Film Festival, which is focusing on mental health issues. And so we're really, you know, just thrilled to be invited. We're going to be the closing night film there. And all
Great.
The films there deal with mental health issues. And The Invisible War, which was nominated for an Oscar, it's the opening film. So we feel like we're in really good company, you know.
Where is that film festival?
Sorry?
Where is that film festival?
Oh, it's in Indianapolis.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's, again, it's the inaugural one. And so, yeah, we're really excited to be a part of that. And after we left Palm Beach, I will say, a little shameless self-promotion, we went off to Sonoma Film Festival and we won the audience.
Yeah, how'd that go?
Yeah, we won the audience award there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and Best American Narrative. So it was kind
gosh.
Of a crazy, it was such a whirlwind, right?
That was all exciting.
In one weekend, too. Yeah, it was really exciting. So we're kind of, you know, on this high from this little festival tour that we went on. So we're just hoping, you know, to keep the momentum going into our distribution rollout.
Mm-hmm. How do people find out more about where it's going next and, you know, when it gets distribution? Do you have a website you want to give out?
Yeah, ashighasthesky.com. It okay. has information on everything on our film, including if you go to the news and reviews page, it'll tell you about, like past reviews, yours is on there, and then we also have a screenings tab as well, and that'll tell them where we're screening next.
Okay,
and
great.
If they want to email us through the contact, I can put them on our email list, and then I can let them know about distribution. We're also on Twitter as High Sky Movie, so we tweet pretty frequently too. It's funny because our audience isn't always in social media. We're rolling. You know, it's interesting. When the film festivals a lot of time have a lot of sort of gritty, edgier films. And so I think the people that gravitate towards ours aren't ones that, you know, they like the idea of this intimate dramedy film. But a lot of our audience members sometimes are older and they're not on Facebook and Twitter. So,
right.
So it's then interesting to kind of keep the momentum going, but they're definitely telling their friends because we keep selling out our screenings, so it's great.
That's great.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now, besides working on this and getting ready for distribution and Film Fest and all that good stuff, do you have anything else in the works for yourself that you're doing?
Yeah. I have the scripts that I wrote that I want to direct. You know, I made As High as the Sky in part to have everybody involved, you know, get more work. So like Caroline and Bonnie and Laurel, I just think that they're these wonderfully deserving actresses that should be working more often. And and also, you know, I think our composer and our DP, anyway, of course, I think everybody on our set was brilliant. So I, of course, think everybody should be working. But yeah, I have my scripts and we're in development on a script called Balloons. So we're in the process of starting to talk with talent to get them attached, and it's this film, As High as the Sky, was self-funded. My other scripts, I'm not going to be able to do that. They're still small budget, but they're bigger than this one was. We're also talking to private investors, and you know, it's a piecemeal thing. It's what every independent film goes through, and it's like a chicken and the egg. So we're just trying to cover all of them at one time, you know, the investors, the distributors, the sales reps, the actors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're busy. That's great.
Yeah, we're busy. Yeah.
Now, do you have a personal website that you also want to give out?
I don't have one, no. I have my Facebook, Nikki Brenlin, but I really have just been rolling through As High as the Sky.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're running out of time, but if there's any last thing that you want to say before we go, that's great.
Oh, no pressure. The pressure's on, Rachel. No, I appreciate you having me. And, yeah, it would be great if people check out our website and shoot us an email, and then I can keep them updated. That would be awesome.
Okay, and then hopefully once you get Balloons going, maybe I can bring you back and we can talk more about that once that's shot.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
Okay. Well, thank you for being on the show today, and I will keep in touch with you, and like I said, hopefully we'll bring you back.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rachel.
All right. Thank you, Nikki.
All right, talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that was Nikki Brandlin, and if you missed any of that show today, you can go back and listen to it again and again and have all your friends listen, please. all of the shows, like I said, are archived, and you can listen to them all. If you ever have an issue listening to a show, please let me know. If you're having a hard time getting in to listen for some reason, please email me. My email address is ravenprods@yahoo.com, ravenprods @yahoo.com. And just let me know if you're having any kind of technical issue with trying to hear the show, any of them, okay? And I've had some great interviews from the Palm Beach Film Festival. Like I said, last week I interviewed John Wager from Comedy Warriors, which is a great documentary. And next week I'm interviewing the director of Dinner en Blanc, which was also shown at the film festival. So I'm trying to get some of these directors that were at the Palm Beach International Film Festival here on the show. And I've got more coming up, so you want to definitely keep tuned here to the show. If you're a director, producer, writer that would like to be on the show, you can also email me at the same address, ravenprods@yahoo.com, and just let me know a little bit about what your piece is about, and I'll see if I can bring you on the show. In addition, please check out my Facebook page, which is Indie Streak, just like this show, and please like the page, because I do put up information on different things, events, castings. The more people I get on there, the more I'm going to post on there. In addition, one more thing, my website, independentstreak.ning, N-I-N-G.com, independentstreak.ning.com has a bunch of information from the film festival, pictures, reviews, interviews, events, all kinds of stuff from the film festival. And I'm going to have additional information about other things that are coming up. I do have a lot of stuff in the Florida area, but I also branch out and talk about other things as well. Of course, these films that I mentioned do get an international audience for being on this show, or just in general, they're out in the film festival circuit. Also, I will be talking more about the movie Rising Tide is coming up here in Hollywood, Florida. It's going to be showing, it's Robert Adanto's film, Rising Tide, in Hollywood on May 16th. So I'm going to be giving you more details on that, because that's a beautiful film that I will probably be attending. And there's a lot of premieres coming up for local independent films. So keep an eye out, because I will be putting up all kinds of stuff soon. All right, guys. Well, join me next week at 1 o'clock, same time. And as always, I thank you for listening in, and I will talk to you later. Okay, bye-bye.